iniciar em português para depois passar para o Peter em inglês. Alguns aspectos logísticos. Primeiro, agradecer a participação. Para nós é muito importante a realização, incluir o Brasil definitivamente como nos nossos projetos, na realização de roundtables. Essa é uma atividade muito específica do IASB e é realizada somente em algumas regiões do mundo. E essa visita ao Brasil, para roundtable especificamente, é de Concept of Framework, desde o início do projeto, o Peter, que é o coordenador do projeto, ele concordou comigo que era muito importante ter visão do Brasil. Nós não realizaremos roundtable no mundo todo, em todas as regiões. Essa é a roundtable na América Latina, exatamente no Brasil. Então é muito importante esse evento para nós aqui no Brasil e para mim particularmente, ter o Brasil definitivamente inserido no âmbito do staff como uma região importante para se ouvir. Segundo aspecto que eu gostaria de destacar é que esse roundtable tem um formato muito também específico. Vocês receberam o link ou os papers que vão ser objeto de discussão. Essa discussão vai ser conduzida pelo Peter. Ele segue exatamente os papers que ali estão identificados de acordo com cada tema e com perguntas específicas. Todo roundtable, essa atividade ela é gravada e ela fica disponível no site do IASB. Portanto, ela é gravada, vai ser em inglês a partir de alguns segundos. E, por gentileza, todas as vezes que vocês forem se manifestar para um ponto, eu só peço, eu na verdade ajudo mais do que quem conduz é o Peter. Então eu só peço que levante essa pequena plaquinha que vocês têm aí, para que eu possa ver quem é para tentar mais ou menos ter uma ordem aqui em termos de participação. Todas as vezes, ao falar, ligar o microfone para que nós obtenhamos a gravação, e ao acabar de falar, desligar o microfone para que o próximo seja ligado. Ok? Então, mais uma vez, moving to English, Peter is with you. I just explained how, in terms of logistics, this is going to work, and particularly the papers that we are going to explore. So, the floor is yours for now.
Okay, thanks, Mauro. Good morning, everybody. Very pleased to see so many people participating in this roundtable. It's a very important part of our process to get feedback from everybody who's interested in our standards, both through comment letters. We hope as many of you as possible will be involved in comment letters. If you want to send comment letters, you don't have to comment on the whole document. The document is quite a long document. It's 200 plus pages. If you're interested in one thing and not interested in the rest, we'd still like to hear from you. So please send in letters. If you have questions about what we've got there as well, but by all means send in questions to the project team as well. There's a lot of information on our website about the project. There's a system of email alerts, so if you want to follow the project, you can sign up for the email alerts. We've been doing a series of webcasts on individual aspects of the project, and they're available on the website. We've done about 5 probably so far, and we plan to do another 3 or 4 as well. So there's lots of information there. For today, we've decided that we would split it basically into 4 areas. So there are 3 topics that we selected in advance, consulting you as well to see what you're interested in. And we picked measurement, presentation of profit or loss, and other comprehensive income, and the distinction between liabilities and equity. And we'll also try and leave some time at the end to, if there are other issues you wish to raise as well. We may not be able to get to all of your issues, of course, but we'll do what we can. So perhaps if I start with the first topic, which is on measurement. And the existing conceptual framework says almost nothing about measurement. It basically has one paragraph, but it doesn't really say anything very useful. And so that's one of the big gaps that we're trying to fill in the framework. And you should have a copy of the paper on measurements. And the first question that we're looking at is, what should we set as the objective of measurements? And what we suggested in the discussion paper is that the objective should be to contribute to the faithful representation of relevant information about the resources of the entity, claims against the entity, and changes in resources and claims, and about how efficiently and effectively the entity's management and governing boards have discharged their responsibilities to use the entity's resources. Now, that objective tries to link back to the objectives of financial reporting that are described in Chapter 1 of the Conceptual Framework. And maybe if I could highlight a couple of things. So what we want to do is to pick a measurement that will generate useful information, not only in the balance sheet, so that's the resources and claims, but also about changes in the resources and claims, so that's income and expense type information. So people sometimes say, we're fixated on the balance sheet, we don't care about the performance statement. That's not true, we do care about the performance statement. And in selecting measurements, we want to consider the nature of the information that will be produced by the measurement. The other aspect I wanted to highlight is that the second, the end of that objective talks about the effective and efficient use of the resources. And that's an objective that people sometimes call stewardship or accountability. It's not set up as a separate objective in Chapter 1 of the Conceptual Framework. It is set up as a component of the overall objective of providing useful information for economic decisions. So the first set of questions we've got for you that we'd like you to discuss is, first of all, do you think the framework should have an overall objective for measurement? And secondly, what do you think of the objective we've proposed?
Ramon, please.
Começar como sempre, né? Thanks, sir. Sorry, needs to be in English. I think it the guidance that was or the discussion in the discussion paper about measurement is certainly extremely helpful, I think. With respect to the objective of measurement, however, it doesn't it seem a little bit like the objective of financial reporting? And I think it has all the elements in it of financial reporting, and then when you continue in paragraph 611, it also passes through all the elements of financial reporting, of relevance and faithfulness, etc. And I think that the definition perhaps, or the objective, sorry, perhaps could be a little bit more specific. I'm not saying that I have the solution already of how and where it should be more specific, but it just gives me a feeling of being very, very general.
I think that's quite an interesting point, and we've had the same reaction from other parts of the world as well. And some have said, if it's just repeating the overall objective, does it serve any purpose? I think what we were trying to do was to provide some context for the discussion of measurement. And of course, the section of the DP and ultimately the framework itself will obviously have more than the objective. We wanted to link what we say in measurement as well back to the objective. So whether we found the right way to do that, I don't know. But I'd be interested in other views on that.
Reading the definition that we have here for measurement, what I was wondering is, I particularly like the IFRS 9 approach that is based on the business model, and I believe that measurement is linked with the business model. Some measurement might be more important for one business model than another one. And what I'm missing here, or at least I'm not able to depict from this here, where the business model enters into the definition of measurement.
Yeah, and I suspect we'll come back to talk a bit more about business models later on when we talk in more detail about how to select a measurement base. So are you suggesting that the objective should actually specifically say something about the business model? So it should be giving relevant information about how the assets are used in the business model, or something like that, or that is consistent with how the assets are used, reflecting the entity's business model?
Nelson?
Well, Peter, to answer your first question, if measurement should be part of the conceptual framework, I agree with the preceding people that already spoke, that it certainly should be there. We need guidance on measurement. We have different kinds of guidances in different standards, and they are not necessarily under the same umbrella. So some sort of statement in that respect is absolutely applicable. I agree that if you manage to include some comments regarding the business model somewhere in either in the definition or in the standard, it might eventually link Tadeu's point to Ruben's point, Ruben's, that it departs a little bit from the trying to mirror the definition of the objective of financial reporting and coming closer to what measurement should really be look like. But I have a question for you in this respect. On section 6 in the overview of your document, it says the objective of measurement is to contribute to the faithful representation of relevant information about II, how efficiently and effectively the entity's management governing board have discharged the responsibilities. Item B says a single measurement basis for all assets and liabilities may not provide the most relevant information. How do you match the need to provide a faithful representation of dischargement of responsibilities with several measurement bases?
Okay, well, perhaps we can come back to that in a second when we talk about that, because the next question will be about single basis versus more than one basis.
João, please.
Thanks, Amar. One thing that I would tell about this, if we need some guidance on measurement, definitely yes. What we have today in the conceptual framework, as you correctly said, Peter, is quite basic, it's not very useful. On the topic, how do we go about the definition of measurement, I think one thing that could be done with this project is, because of the fact that we don't have any guidance on the conceptual framework, we end up in a situation where measurement comes very scattered across a number of different standards. A lot of people say that, you know, measurement is not consistent with the way assets are managed, for example, or liabilities are managed, and we end up with a lot of criticism that you know much, much better than I do, which is whatever we have in these scattered standards doesn't reflect the economic reality and doesn't reflect the way people manage assets and liabilities, and ultimately it doesn't reflect on the accounts the consequence of the actions that the preparers take. So one thing that we could do with this project is to provide an umbrella set of principles around measurement that would allow you, in situations where you don't have an appropriate measurement basis or you have doubts about the appropriate measurement basis for a certain transaction, for example, you can go back to the conceptual framework and say, here's what I'm trying to represent, here's the objective, here's the principle behind the measurement attribute of a certain of IFRS, and here's the way I'm going to do it. So you have that opportunity this time around to do that, and I think that's the crux of the problem in my view.
Okay, I think there's an interesting point there which isn't in a way directly linked to this topic, but might be one of the other points we might want to come back to in the final session, which is who's the framework mainly for and what's it to be used for? And so we've had a discussion there about whether it's for all the possible users, the board, the preparers, the users, the auditors and regulators and so on. Or is it, should it be primarily directed at the board with the other people more, their use more a kind of byproduct of the primary purpose? So that would be a good point to come back to. And I think we were keen to emphasize that the framework doesn't override standards. It can, of course, help fill in the gaps between the standards, which I guess is probably what you were talking about.
Yeah,
Ramon.
If I might just add to that, both actually to Tadeo's point and Jean's point, is, well, first of all, the business model. I think that later on in the discussion paper, there is a section on the business model, which I personally found extremely helpful, and which you see coming back also in more recent standards, and makes, to me at least, makes complete sense. And I think it should get a more prominent place in the whole conceptual framework, because it can help you indeed with measurement. It can also perhaps, I was thinking, help within the performance measurement, the distinction between profit and loss and OCI, where it doesn't figure there at this moment. While I think it is an extremely useful addition. To Zhao's point, I have the same feeling. To me, at this moment, the conceptual framework sets too few limits. It sets few limits in measurement, but also, for example, with unit of account, where there is a freedom of option offered that is quite limitless, and that worries me to the extent if I imagine myself in a situation of IS 8 and I don't have an accounting policy and I need to develop some sort of accounting policy that makes sense, then I need, even though I know that all the standards they are more relevant than the conceptual framework, still if I have to go back to the conceptual framework, I must find some sort of basis there that limits me in my options, and that makes me develop something that is in the philosophy of Yazdi. And that I wanted to add that to João's point, because that is for me still missing a little bit at this moment. Obviously, it's just a discussion paper, but you see some tendencies developing, and especially with unit of account and the existence uncertainty, etc., I found that it perhaps leaves too many options open.
Okay, perhaps if I can pick up on maybe three aspects of your comments there. I think, first of all, on the question of the purpose of the framework, again, in a way, I think you made an important point there, which we didn't really capture in the DP, and I wish we had picked it up in the DP. And that's that although we've said the board is the sort of primary intended audience for the conceptual framework, I think the framework does play a very important role in setting the tone for the whole set of standards. And I think that's very important for everybody. It's not just for the board, so that people understand how the individual standards fit into the whole. And then I think, as you said in your comments, really, that in trying to understand and apply and interpret the standards, that they really should take their lead from the framework. And I think it does play a very important role in that sense, even if you're not necessarily directly deciding something on the basis of the framework. In terms of unit of account, in some ways that's quite an unsatisfactory area of the DP, but I'm not sure how we can do any better. We would love to say something in the framework about how to pick the unit of account. And in the DP, we ended up saying, pick a unit of account that gives relevant information. If we can find a way to say something more useful, I'd love to do that. At the moment, I don't really see the way to provide something more useful. If the people in the room come up with some good ideas on units of account, that's one area where I'd be particularly interested in suggestions. I probably wouldn't bet on us coming up with anything very useful to say, but it would be nice to try. In terms of the business model, there is a discussion in the measurement section and in one or two other parts of the DEP, but probably particularly the measurement section, and we'll come on to that in a few minutes. One thing we didn't do two things really. We didn't try to define the business model precisely. So in the measurement section, we suggested that the way to pick the most appropriate measurement is by considering how the assets are used. We didn't make it as specific as saying what the business model looks like or how the assets are used in line with the business model or something like that. And in a sense, we felt it was maybe more useful to keep the discussion a bit more generic than that. If we wanted to put a lot of burden on the business model, a lot of emphasis on the business model, we probably ought to come up with a description of what we mean by it. And at least speaking personally, I was a bit worried that if we said lots of things in the framework should depend directly on the business model, it might end up being too limiting if we've come up with a very precise definition of what it is, because we might end up excluding things that aren't quite business models but are in the same general direction. So we deliberately didn't use the word business model in the measurement section, or really in most of the rest of the paper. There is a question in section 9 of the DP about the business model and whether there is something more useful that we should be saying about it, and whether particularly we should be saying something maybe more overarching at the front of the framework, because as Sadeva said, I think quite a lot of people have suggested that we ought to set the business model up as one of the cornerstones really of the framework and build a lot on that. We haven't gone for that approach, but if you think we should do that, it would be very useful if you could be as specific as possible about how you think we should use it, what you have in mind with the business model, and so on.
If I just add a little bit, Peter is right when he mentioned the pressure that we have from time to time in the board when we discuss business model and the request for us to define it. Although it's an idea that almost everyone has when they are associating a particular business to the way the management conduct its activities, it's been quite difficult or hard for us into our accounting framework, in an accounting literature, to define business model. So would be particularly interesting if you do have ideas about how we could better frame it in order to give us enough room when developing particularly standards. So I guess I go back to Tadeu's point on IFRS 9. I particularly support strongly the way IFRS 9 framed the business model relationship with, I would say, relationship with the classification of financial instruments, and that classification influencing the measurement attribute. Because my experience in the financial sector in particular, when it comes to securities and financial instruments as a whole, is that they are hugely influenced by the way the management deals with their financial instruments. But then again, we explored in that particular standard. So the conceptual framework should give us enough room to explore it in a way that better portray a particular standard that we are developing. So ideas in this particular issue would be very, very, very welcome. Professor Eliseu, please.
Can I go back a little bit? I really don't see it necessary to discuss about the measurement itself, because if you define the objective of financial reporting, measurement just should help for arrive at this objective. It has not a specific or different objective. And see what's happening, at least in my interpretation. In paragraph 6-7, objective of financial reporting is to provide financial information about the reporting entity that is used for existing and potential investors, lenders, and other creditors. That's a little bit narrow, but that's what I discussed. In making decisions about providing research to the entity. See that in paragraph 6-7, the concept of accountability is included. At least I read it this way, okay? Predictions of future cash flows is included. So it's a really wide objective. When you read this paragraph 6-10, So the preliminary view about objective of measurement is to contribute to faithful representation, not relevant, and so on, and in the end, about how efficient and effective the entity's management and governing board have discharged their responsibility to use the entity's resources. See that in paragraph 610, it's much more direct to the test, to accountability, how they have discharged their responsibility to the use of the entity research. So it is not, let's say, combined very well, 6 and 6.10. Just because we were here trying to, let's say, giving two different objectives to the financial reporting and to the measurement. And I would say that it has to be the same objective.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think in trying to link back to the overall objective, it's possible we may have inadvertently looked as though we were changing the emphasis, which wasn't the idea. One other thing people have been confused with in 6.10 as well is that we're not trying to provide the assessment of the stewardship ourselves, but we're trying to provide the input to help users make those assessments. And I think the wording in 6.10 probably is a bit unclear on that point. I've got one eye on the clock, so we should probably move on to the next aspect, which is discussed in paragraph 5 down to 9 of the paper, and that's about how many measurement bases we have. And what we've suggested in the DP is that there isn't a single basis that will work in all circumstances. We need probably need more than one. But at the same time, we don't think we should have a very wide range of different measurement bases, because when you put the financial statements together as a whole, it can make it more difficult to understand if there are too many. So we said that we should limit the number. Some people have misunderstood what we meant there. We didn't mean create some sort of artificial limit on the number, but that we should make sure that we don't use any more than we really need. So I'd like to invite comments on that.
Eric, please.
I think that the idea of limiting the number of different measures can, in the future, maybe leave room for more inconsistencies between the conceptual framework and the standard. So I'm not against limiting the number of different measures, but the categories used have to be wide, cannot be too strict categories in order to restrict too much the idea of how the specific standards will be treating the measurements. So I think that's a point that has to be taken in consideration, that to be very careful with the way the categories are defined so that it's not too constraining for the standards to work on those categories. One thing that I think that maybe has to be considered, probably not, maybe not here on the idea of the categories, but is that I know that the discussion paper is not considering the capital maintenance, and I think that it's very, very problematic to discuss measurements without discussing the capital maintenance idea. And when we define the categories without considering the idea of capital maintenance, that can be problematic, especially when we're talking about inflation and when we're talking about other aspects and especially the entry and exit costs. So when defining those categories, I think that the idea of the capital maintenance has to be brought to attention.
I should probably make a couple of points on those comments. First of all, I should probably explain the relationship between the revised framework and the standards, and what will happen if the framework is inconsistent with an existing standard. Well, the framework, of course, doesn't override standards, so the, the standard will stay as it is until the board decides to change it. Before the board starts a project to change a standard, it will have to go through the usual agenda setting process, including the next consultation on the agenda, which we expect will be sometime around about 2015. So if at that stage we identify some standard that's completely inconsistent with the framework, or even maybe inconsistent with part of it, the board would need to consider that fact, and that would be one of the inputs into the next agenda. But of course it won't be the only input, so that it, you know, that may be a high priority, it may be a low priority, it depends what else is in the mix at the time. I think when we do the exposure draft, we probably ought to highlight for the readers any major conflicts we're aware of so that people can give us informed comments. But I think an actual program for dealing with any inconsistencies would be really to deal with in the agenda consultation. On capital maintenance, in a sense we tried to defer considering that, really for two reasons. The first reason is that, as I'm sure you know, there have been discussions that we should, or considerations that we should look at IS 29 again and see whether it makes sense. So if we do some work on that, that seemed like a good time really to start thinking about those issues. We also think that dealing with those issues is quite a big project and would be quite time consuming. And so our conclusion was that we ought to try and make other improvements to the framework first and not be slowed down by trying to deal with inflation accounting and capital maintenance adjustments at the same time. Now, I think we would be very interested in comments on whether that's a strategy that works or whether it's just too much interrelated for us to ignore. So in the DP, we've basically assumed away the inflation problem. We've not discussed it at all. There are some places where we talk about costs. We've deliberately tried to be a bit vague about whether that's historic cost or replacement cost, because it's starting to get into that debate. So we've really tried to defer that question as much as possible.
Fabio?
About a question, I agree that, or I understand actually, that the idea of limiting the number of different measures, I think it makes sense, but I'm concerned about sometimes we need different bases, because sometimes business is complex. So I don't know if to change on different measuring bases is just because business are complex. So I sort of like thinking about like as a company with different types of assets and liabilities, and sometimes talking about limiting the number maybe could not match relevant information.
Nelson?
On your question, Peter, about capital maintenance, I am informed that there is a joint effort of some South American countries trying to put up before the board a suggestion of an inflation standard. And perhaps if that is supposed to move fastly, or as fastly as possible, it might be interesting to have something in the conceptual framework in order that you can embed the idea of inflation standard in the future already contemplated here.
Yeah, and I think that's a question of timing as much as anything else. If that work is sort of well developed on the timescale we want to develop for the framework, we can build it in then. If it's on a longer timescale, we can always add it afterwards if we need to.
Tadeu.
About the question, I agree that we should not have a single basis measurement. But in terms of limiting the number of different measures, that's a big challenge for the board, because it's always difficult. I understand that if you have less, you may have less complexity as well. But at the same time, you do not leave the alternative depending on the type of business for each of the companies. I know that you don't like this, but I'm just going back to the business model. But I understand the effort of the board in terms of trying to limit the number of measurement pairs. I agree that it brings less complexity.
And I think we've probably not expressed it very well in the VP, but I think one thing we were trying to do with saying limit the number is that when you're picking a measurement basis for a particular asset, it's not just a question of looking at that asset in isolation, but you want to look at the whole financial statement. So it's sort of saying, take a step back and see what the whole picture looks like. I think that's quite a large part of what we were trying to convey. So the next issue then is, if we're going to have more than one basis, how does the board decide what basis to use and when? And so we've discussed that in paragraphs 10 through 12. And what we've suggested is that it depends on how the asset is being used and how the liability will be settled. As I mentioned earlier, we haven't made that as specific as saying it depends on what the business model looks like. So I think the words that are in the DP could certainly be consistent with a business model approach, but they could be consistent with other things as well. They could be consistent with management intent, for example, or making some sort of forecast about what might happen. And we felt really that possibly for the framework, we shouldn't be as specific as saying something like the business model. In terms of liability, I think that discussion of how the liability will be settled is probably not as useful as it is on the asset side, because most liabilities are settled by being fulfilled, not by being transferred in some way. So it's probably not as useful a decision point, or at least it's a sort of empty decision point for most liabilities probably. But I'd be very interested in comments on whether you think that's the right sort of approach. Should it depend on how the asset is being used, how the liability has been settled? Or should it depend on something else? Should it be more specific, like business model, for example?
Isabel, please.
I would like to start with a question. Based on this discussion paper, the option of using the revaluation model for property, plant and equipment would be removed from IFRS, or not? What's the idea?
No, and in a sense we weren't trying to look ahead to that, because it depends a bit why you think the revaluation model is being used, probably. I suspect that when it was originally put in, it was largely trying to do current costs and some sort of capital maintenance type adjustment. But there were no basis for conclusions when that was first put in. I think to some extent we're guessing, and some of the subsequent changes aren't necessarily that consistent with that objective. So I think we weren't trying to say we wouldn't address revaluations. So we weren't trying to say we're deciding what we would do with revaluations. When we talk later on about possible loss and other comprehensive income, I think the revaluation model doesn't fit in very well with what we've done there, or what we've discussed there. But if you saw it as being intended to provide capital maintenance, then there might be a role for it, and we're trying to defer that issue. So I think the short answer is we're not trying to answer that question one way or the other at the moment.
Ramon?
I had one question, but after a comment that Peter made, I now have two. I think that, again, makes sense. The measurement would depend on how assets contribute to future cash flows and how the entity will settle or fulfill a liability. I think that specifically goes for subsequent measurement. It seems that on initial measurement, even in the guidance that is provided now in the paragraph 61 until, well, far away, it seems that initial measurement depends mostly on the type of transaction and the type of asset, not necessarily on the way assets are contribute and how liabilities are settled. it also, when I was starting to read it, immediately this statement brought day one results into my mind. And the board in paragraph 67 does get to the point of day one gain and losses, but I think that if this is the objective, if this is where we want to go with measurement and also for initial recognition, I think the board must be very clear on day one losses and gains. And then I heard you say something about management intent and expectations about the future. And now with your comment and reading this, I understand that better. However, it does bring a certain concern about, especially for the next discussion on liabilities. Actually, we're not going to discuss that today. And the recognition of liabilities and the views of the unconditional, practically unconditional, and conditional approach, because if you in measurement want to include intent specifically as well, then you will need to address that issue also at the liability recognition, because I am assuming that it's not only if it's an element of measurement, it's also an element of recognition, perhaps, or it might be considered also an element of recognition. And specifically in Brazil, and I'm not sure in other countries of the region as well, intent and compulsion are still widely used and defended by regulators and standard setters as an element of recognition. Despite everything the board and IFRIC have said, it still figures highly in the discussions and on paper as well. So if your intention really is to include management intent as well outside only the business model approach, then I think that is a very important element to address in the final exposure draft.
Okay, let me pick up a couple of those things. First of all, on the initial measurements, we made an assumption in the paper, which I think isn't probably totally valid, or at least isn't discussed enough, and that was that in an exchange transaction, it doesn't matter very much whether you describe that initial measurement as cost or as a current value, for example, a fair value, on the assumption that they'll be roughly equal. And that does sort of rather ignore a discussion about exit versus entry prices and transaction costs and so on. And we probably should have had more discussion of that in there. We've also said that if the number is roughly the same, regardless of whether you call it a cost or a current value on day one, then the best description to pick is one that's consistent with what you're doing in subsequent measurements. So if the subsequent measurement is going to be cost-based, then it probably makes more sense to describe that number as cost on day one. If the subsequent measure is going to be a current value, then it probably makes more sense to describe it as a current value on day one as well. Now, in terms of management intent and so on, I think the way I saw it, and it's probably going a bit too far to say that the board really discussed this, but the way I saw it was we were leaving something fairly generic in the framework, and so we have the discussion about how the asset will be used, and then the particular way the board would implement that would be more of a standards level decision. So for example, in IFRS 9, the board has decided that the criterion should be business model, and it may make that decision in other standards, but it might also decide in other standards that something other than the business model is the best way to do it, whether it's management intent or a forecast of what might happen. Maybe there are other possibilities. So we thought for the framework it might be useful to leave it a bit more open, but the board would still need to decide what to do in the individual standards. In terms of in compulsion and the discussion of liabilities, I mean, if we have time, maybe we should come back to that in the final session. But to me, the big issue there is, do you have an obligation or not? The corner piece, really, of the definition of a liability is that you have an obligation today. So really, the first thing you have to decide is, do you have an obligation? And it seems difficult for intent by itself to play that much of a role in deciding whether you have an obligation. Once you've decided that you've got an obligation, obviously the next question is, and if it meets the rest of the definition, the next question is, do you want to recognise it? And we suggested in the recognition session that depends on whether it's giving relevant information, faithful representation, cost benefit, and so on. And it's conceivable that intent might play some role in that decision process. For example, you might feel that intent plays some role in deciding whether the information will be relevant or not. It wouldn't be there as explicit criterion, but if the board felt it was useful, maybe it could incorporate it at that point. But I think that the question of intent there is really separate from the question of do you have an obligation or not. And if you don't have an obligation, then it's very difficult to recognise something as a liability when you don't have an obligation at all.
Eric?
I like the idea of the first question here, that the use of the asset is important. That leads to the idea of using the business model as relevant for choosing the measure, and I completely agree with that. But I would like to come to another point that is in the same question, is the idea of using one measurement in the primary, let's say the balance sheet, and another measurement for profit and loss. I think that that is related with the concept of OCI. We're probably going to be discussing that in more depth later, but I think that maybe there should be, not only on the OCI, but also on the measurement part, some limitation on when it's possible to use two measurements at the same time. I think that is it can be very confusing, and I think that when this option is taken to use two measurements, it has to be on the OCI and never in profit and loss. So here there's an answer here. A question here that is amounts recognized in profit and loss. I think there should never be in the profit and loss a result that is different from the measurement that is used for the assets and the liabilities. I think that's a point that has to be very carefully looked upon, because it can be very confusing to see a balance sheet with one measurement and then you see profit and loss with another measurement. And if that's done, I think that it should be on OCI and not on profit and loss. I think that's a very important point.
Eliseo?
Just to say, let's be a little bit careful, because when we say it's a particular asset should depend on how it contributes to future cash flows, all the inventories are kept to produce cash flows by being sold. Some generalizations could make us go to the fair value for all the inventories.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the parts of the DP that's probably not well enough explained. A lot of people have raised that question. I think our view was that you wouldn't necessarily be using a current exit price for inventories, but I think we've not provided a good explanation in the DP of why that really is. And to my mind, the explanation really is that, as I understand it, when users are looking at an operating type business, obviously what they want to do is look at the future cash flows from the business. And they're really interested, they're not that interested in how much you can sell today, the inventory that you have today. They're interested in forecasting the entire stream. And providing current value for the inventory is not necessarily providing them any more information, and it may get in the way. And what they're interested in really in looking at is seeing how the margins behave and how they might change in the future. And as I said, obviously we're trying not to discuss the question of whether by cost there we meant original cost or replacement cost. We leave that for future consideration. So I think we should have provided a better explanation there of what was going on. We should probably move on. Maybe if we just take a couple of minutes over question four. We've mentioned there that the point we've already discussed probably a couple of times, that selecting the measurement should depend on the information that's produced both in the balance sheet and in the performance statements. And secondly, also obviously we would consider cost-benefit type issues. Did anybody have any comments or questions on that, on those points?
Fabiano? I would like to make a comment regarding different measurement bases for financial statement of financial position and statement of profit and loss. I think to answer this question, we need to define what performance is in terms of profit and loss and statement of financial position. I think without defining performance, we cannot answer this question properly. The proposal of breathing items, I think, is a practical expedient. It's proposed in the IFRS 9, but there are no conceptual bases that support the breathing item. I think the definition of performance would.
Okay, well, if nobody else has anything burning to say, that's probably a good link into the next session then on profit loss and OCI. So thanks for that. Okay, so the paper and presentation or loss of profit or loss and other comprehensive income. And we're looking at this because a lot of the responses to our agenda consultation in 2011 said they didn't understand why we were using OCI. The board had never explained what it was trying to do. There didn't seem to be any consistent rationale for how it was being used. The first thing we looked at was whether we should try to define financial performance. And we came to the conclusion that we shouldn't try to define it because we thought it would be very difficult to define and because we thought people would have different views of what performance is. And also I think because it's very emotive, because it suggests that people are going to be judged. And we felt that trying to define one number as performance is really just an impossible task and probably not going to have a useful outcome. So we thought it was better to emphasize that when people are looking at financial performance, they look at a range of factors. So they look at the different types of income and expense in profit or loss. They also look at information in the balance sheet. They look at the cash flow statement. They look at the disclosures. And there isn't a single magic number that will give you everything. So we decided not to try and define financial performance. So be interested in views on whether you think we should define it. And I think in your comment letters, if you do suggest that we should define it, I think for some of these difficult problems, if respondents say we think you should do something, that's not always very helpful if you don't give us a clue about how to do it. So I think if you suggest that we should try and define financial performance, it would be much more helpful if you could try and explain roughly how you think we should do it. Not necessarily the answer, but at least let us know whether an answer exists and it's feasible to find an answer.
Fabiano?
In terms of what should be recognized in P&L and what should be recognized in OCI, I think that the board should define define in conceptual terms what P&L is and what OCI is. Otherwise, we're going to have only practical experience. And I believe that to achieve this, we need to explain what performance is. And I think it's a good starting point to define what P&L is, taking into consideration that P&L is the primary source of financial performance. DDP is trying to capture what distorts P&L and recognize it in OCI instead of defining the proper concepts. And I think that if an item affects the performance, it should be recognized in P&L. Otherwise, it should be recognized in OCI. And if in the future the item in subsequent affects the performance, it should be recycled from OCI to P&L. So everything is based on performance definition.
Let me make one comment and then I'll ask you a question. As I said, we didn't try to define financial performance. And really, for similar reasons, we also didn't try to define profit or loss, because we felt that would be as difficult as trying to define financial performance. We could produce a definition of profit or loss that is just a kind of shopping list of things that go into profit or loss. And the danger of that, of course, is shopping lists are never complete, and we'd end up leaving something out of profit or loss that we probably don't want to leave out. So that's why we thought it was really safer. We think it, unless you can come up with a really clean conceptual definition of profit or loss and OCI, you'll end up with something in between that doesn't fit either. So we thought we probably need to define one and then have the other as the sort of default category that captures everything else. And so we thought it really was safer to define a limited population that goes in OCI and leave everything else in P&L. So my question for you is, if you think we should define profit or loss, do you have an idea of what the definition might look like?
At the moment, no.
Ramon?
I would say tentatively, but really tentatively, because I understand the difficulty of the discussion. I appreciate that. But I think also that at heart, the question of performance is a discussion on what is profit and loss versus OCI, and what is recycling versus not recycling. And I think there is a, you now have people, you have two different views where you see profit and loss only as a consequence of performance, or you can see the profit and loss as a subset of performance. And when I look again at Brazil, the profit distribution depends on how you define on what is profit and loss, because IFRS is for all intents and purposes statutory GAAP, and not having a clear definition somehow feels counterintuitive to me. And then I'm sure you're going to ask me the same question you asked Fabiano. So anticipating that, it is, I find it an extremely difficult question, but you could, and I don't have a definition, but you could think of exploring, should financial statements give the user information to assess performance, or should it present the assessment itself? You can look at stewardship versus value. You can look at an entity reporting versus management reporting versus reporting on individual instruments. It depends. The definition, I guess, will depend on what view you in the end will take on what the financial statements as a whole should provide the user with. As a but, I would say in countries like Brazil, because I'm sure that Brazil is not the only one, the effects will be quite significant because of the fact that whatever is called profit and loss will be the amount that is distributable. And that might not be an issue in other countries.
Ricardo? Thank you, Amaro.
Peter, I agree that it's quite very, very difficult to define financial performance. Therefore, avoiding that should be safer. But avoiding defining profit or loss as well is too safe and probably not effective. I wonder if an approach as the ISB uses to define equity should fit properly for profit or loss. For instance, if you decide define equity as asset minus liability, why not define profit or loss as income less expenses? And then if we end up with a definition that doesn't solve our problems, probably the definition of income or the definition of expenses are not good enough, and we should revise that. But avoiding those discussions to find a safer place to work on probably will not end with a better solution.
That's linked to another question, I guess, which is how many elements should we have? So in the DP, we suggested keeping two elements to the performance statement, income and expense. Another approach would be to say you want two elements for profit or loss and another two elements for the things that go into OCI. We decided not to do that because we thought that going for definitions to distinguish things in P&L from OCI was no easier than trying to do it by subdividing the income and expenses through some set of criteria. And you'll see as we get later on in the discussion that we felt as well that the distinction shouldn't be extremely rigid, so the board would have some flexibility still to decide whether to use OCI in some cases where OCI might seem to fit. And it's more difficult to do that probably if you use definitions as the basis for the distinction. My worry about trying to define it is just as income less expenses is that I don't think it necessarily responds to what people were looking for when they were looking for a definition. I think it might feel like quite a mechanical definition and not really something that captures the essence of what they think that number is trying to be. And I know it's very difficult to define. I don't think we probably can define the essence, but I don't know that just describing it as income less expenses meets what people were looking for when they suggested that we should try and define it in a more kind of conceptual way.
Ricardo, so can I ask a question to Ricardo? I don't know if it's procedure, but just for me to put your comment in context, when you say you define equity as assets less liability, so why don't you define profit and loss as income less expenses? When you go back to measurement basis, would you say in order for me to understand it better, would you say you need to use the same measurement basis for the balance sheet or the financial statement of financial position and income statement, or can there be differences?
If there are differences, maybe the difference is not an income, neither an expense, should be classified as defined as another term, therefore would be outside profit or loss, would go to OCI. Why should we define income as an increase in asset or decrease in liability that increases equity? That's mechanical. That's not a definition. That doesn't present a concept either.
Fabiano.
I'd like to complement what Ramon just mentioned about the distribution of dividends. In Brazil, dividends are distributed based on profit and loss. And profit and loss is affected by gain or losses that can be partially or fully reversed in subsequent periods. And according to the DP, some items will continue to be affected by, such as foreign currency debt, and other items that will be fully or partially reversed in the future would not. And what's the concept? Because if the concept is items that are fully or partially reversed could be recognized in OCI, what's the distinction between one item and another?
Tadeu.
Well, I like the idea of having the possibility of measuring items on the balance sheet and income statement differently, and using the OCI as a reconciling this difference. But the only point that is linked with Fabian and Ramon's comment is that I believe that they should all be recycled at a certain point of time. I honestly, until now, cannot understand why gain and losses are not recycled, and definitely it has some repercussion in terms of dividends in Brazil.
Eric, please.
I agree with Ricardo's position of the definition of profit and loss. It's pretty much close to the idea of equity. It's just the difference between income and expense. But one thing that I think that we have to maybe go a little bit deeper in that is if whatever goes to OCI is an income and an expense. And in my opinion, it is an income and an expense. What goes to OCI should be an income and an expense that should not be considered in the profit or loss in that period, but in future periods. Whatever is not supposed to be on this period, and it is an income and expense, it should go to OCI, and then, as a consequence of this thought, it has to be recycled, just like Tadeu said. Everything that goes into OCI should be recycled. And for me, the difference between what income and expenses that goes to profit and loss and income and expenses that go to OCI is the timing of when that income and expense should be recognized as a profit or loss of the period. And then thus everything that goes to OCI is an income and expense of future periods, and then therefore in the future they should be recycled and go to profit and loss.
Fabiano.
It's an additional question. Just to complement what I just said, why there are some items that go to P&L, as I said, foreign currency debt, and others that go to OCI, take into consideration that both items partially or fully reverse in future periods. What's the conceptual basis for that?
Well, that's the problem we're trying to answer, because the OCI developed piecemeal, and it's been a little bit like a snowball. It was used once or twice and then started being used more and more, but there hasn't been a consistent basis. So what we're trying to do is create some order into that chaos, I think.
Yeah, I think this is one of the, in hearing the discussions, when Eric's comment on the P&L and OCI split, let's say. So if I'm hearing that without considering anything, I'm hearing that in his view, probably performance is P&L, and not consider OCI, because performance is somehow, this is my reading, associated with that period. So the performance in that period is or should be represented by P&L. So then comes again, the question comes back to the definition of performance again. So it's not an easy task. I would really encourage you to think about that and try to help us. You see, when we hear from, for instance, academics, their definition or their perception of performance is one. Preparers tend to have sometimes a different one, and users sometimes have even distinct ones. Some users consider might consider performance as including everything, including in that sense OCI as well. So some users have the perception that because of the lack of a strong conceptual basis for OCI, everything for them is performance. In particular industries, in others no. So it's not an easy task. It's truly difficult for us, and we've debated this quite at length when developing the discussion paper. And this is something that we are really, really, everything we are interested, but some aspects we are truly interested in the way we are framing the characterization of OCI. And I would just reinforce what Peter said. Well, OCI was developed as a way to accommodate some aspects of measurement and performance in the mind of the board. So if we do remind the corridor in IS 19 and OCI was key to accommodate that corridor development in IS 19. And then comes after that, we started using OCI to accommodate other aspects of measurement that was in some way always linked to performance. So yesterday, just to invite you, yesterday we discussed a little bit the model that we are developing for insurance, for instance. So it would be interesting, in my point of view, of course, if we could try to apply this to the standards that we are developing right now, because they are together with the conceptual framework. We intend, of course, to have these new standards aligned with the conceptual framework, at least in the way we are thinking about the conceptual framework. So it's truly an issue that we are very much interested in hearing, because we gave a lot of thought in this aspect, in the definition of performance and P&L and OCI. So I guess Ramon has one additional comment, right?
Yeah, I can never resist. Hearing the comments, those against recycling of OCI, they say that the reclassification adjustments made on recycling may not meet the definitions of income and expense if they do not arise from a change in entities recognized assets and liabilities. That perhaps might be true. On the other hand, they do arise from the performance of the entity. So in that respect, I think things should be recycled. When you look at bridging items and when you look at the recycling of mismatched remeasurements, you can all get that into, if you don't get it into changes of assets and liabilities, you can get it into performance, I think. However, when you look at transitory remeasurement and the approach that is proposed by the board, then I think that doesn't fit neither in assets and liabilities nor in performance. It seems just a way to get the result that you are looking for, with respect. But I cannot understand exactly that category, but I'm saying that on my own, because as a network we haven't really taken that discussion yet. And I mentioned it earlier, but I'm really not sure if it will work. If you look at profits and loss and OCI and performance, would any sort of business model approach help you in? And I haven't developed anything of it. Would it help you in getting those definitions clearer, or defining what is performance or what is profits and loss? It's something that came up, and I have not been able to discard it yet.
Yeah, we looked at a few things. I'm not sure we've necessarily quite finished looking at the business model and whether there might be something in there that we could use as a basis for the distinction. We haven't found something so far, I think, but we should probably keep looking at that. I'd probably like to move on now, because we've spent a fair bit of time discussing question one. Quite a few of the other questions we've probably partly answered already. Question two was asking whether you agree that we should keep profit or loss as an important total or subtotal, that is something different from just the total of comprehensive income. I guess it's probably implicit in most of your comments. Does there anybody who think we shouldn't keep profit or loss as an important total or subtotal?
Yes, okay. The discussion question one anticipated the response for Jesus.
I think so. Yeah. We may well have answered question three as well, which is about whether you think we should have recycling. Okay. Quite a few of you have said we should have recycling. Was there anybody who was of the other view?
Eliseo?
If the defining financial performance is difficult or impossible, at least then let's use the word result, net result, all over the life of the entity should be defined. Because if you define the net result, for example, the difference of funds provided by the owners to the entity against the funds from the to that, if you define the net result as a profit and loss, if there is OCI, everything that goes to the OCI has to be recycled. Or if you define as the comprehensive income, nothing can be recycled. What doesn't fit in my mind is some things being recycled and others not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's certainly the way the debate has tended to be in the past. You either believed in one statement and saw it all as performance and didn't recycle, or you viewed P&L as the real performance statement and wanted everything to pass through P&L at some point. I might just come back to that point in a minute when I talk about the categories we've identified. We discussed in we probably discussed a fair bit of question four as well, which I think paragraph 16 lists a few things that we considered as a basis for the distinction, and we decided none of them really worked that well, so we didn't use them. And as we mentioned before, we decided that profit or loss should be the thing that captures everything other than the things that are specifically decided to go into OCI. Did anybody have any more they wanted to discuss on those points, or have we covered that enough already?
Fabiano?
I'd like to make an additional comment. I'm aware that we not going to talk about primary financial statements, but I think that P&L and OCI should not be combining in just one primary financial statement, taking into consideration that users think that profit and loss has more prominence than OCI that provides financial performance information.
Do you think that's a question we should address in the conceptual framework, or do you think we should deal with that in IS1? Because our conclusion was that we thought whether it's one statement or two is more a kind of standards level decision, so we haven't addressed it in the DP. The final question is looking at our attempt to describe what might go into OCI. And we identified three categories, which some of you have mentioned already. One category is bridging items. And the notion here is that you're using one measurement as a basis for, or one measurement in the balance sheet, and another measurement as the basis for determining the amounts in profit or loss. So an example there is in the classification and measurement exposure draft, the category of fair value through OCI for some debt instruments. You'd be using fair value in the balance sheet. You'd be using amortized costs to decide what amounts go into profit or loss. And the other sort of live example we have of that is the insurance contracts ED, where the measure uses current discount rates for the balance sheet, and it uses the original discount rates, the ones that existed at inception, for determining the amounts in profit or loss. So the notion there really is that you're giving a two-dimensional view of an asset or liability, and you're using accumulated OCI as the bridge between those two measurements. And it's really the accumulated OCI that provides the bridge. In a sense, the OCI for the current period is just a movement in a difference, so it doesn't have such an easily describable meaning. But the accumulated OCI does have more of a describable meaning. For example, if you've got a debt instrument where you're using this approach, the accumulated OCI shows the gain or loss you'd have if you sold the instrument immediately. In the insurance contract ED, the accumulated OCI is a kind of snapshot of your exposure to interest rate mismatch, particularly if you've got assets where you're also using that category of fair value through OCI. Then if you've got a significant duration mismatch, the amount in accumulated OCI is going to reflect the extent of that mismatch and the extent of interest rate changes there have been since inception. So there, particularly the accumulated OCI has got some meaning. The movement, it's slightly more questionable what the meaning is. It's got some components. Some components have some meaning, some have a bit less meaning. So that was the first category. And we also concluded that if you were using the bridging item notion, then you would have to recycle, because the only way of satisfying that objective of using a basis consistently for presentation on P&L would be to recycle. So for example, if amortized cost is your basis, you would have to recycle on disposal, because that's what you would get if you're using amortized cost as your measurement basis. The mismatch remeasurement notion was that you're remeasuring some asset or liability, but it's linked to something else that isn't yet captured in the financial statements. So for example, in the cash flow hedge, you've got the derivative, the fair value of the derivative is changing, but it's there to hedge a transaction that hasn't yet occurred. And so the notion was that OCI is being used as a sort of temporary parking space until you can account for both parts of the sort of linked item in the same place. Where would you account for them together? Well, you could account for them together in OCI, but it does seem more natural to account for them together in P&L. And so that, again, leads you naturally to recycling if you have the mismatch remeasurements. The third category we identified is really because those first two categories are quite restrictive. It's quite a bit more restrictive than we have in the existing standards today. And there are some things that don't really fit those notions. For example, you were asking earlier about fixed asset revaluations. Well, they don't really fit into the bridging notion at the moment, the way we do the accounting, for two reasons. One is that the depreciation is based on revalued amount. It's not based on original cost. And secondly, there's no recycling on disposal. So it would be difficult really to come up with a measurement that is consistent with cost less accumulated depreciation based on revalued amount. So if we wanted to make fixed asset revaluation fit the bridging notion, we could, but we'd have to change the accounting we do afterwards. Another item which came up quite large in the board's discussion was pensions. For pensions, the actuarial gains and losses go to OCI, but it doesn't fit with the bridging notion. And the reason it doesn't fit is that you can't construct a liability measurement that is consistent with the amounts that are going through profit or loss. So if I give you an example, let's say that the service cost this year is 10, and then the next year, the service cost with exactly the same facts, everything else unchanged, but just there's been a change in some assumptions, is now 12 for that year. So if you think of our liability, our total liability for the 2 years is now going to be 24, because the assumption change also affected last year's service. But the accumulated amount we've had through P&L is only 22, 10 in the first year and 12 in the second year. And you can't construct a liability measurement that's consistent with the 22, except as an accumulation of the individual years. But it wouldn't really make sense as a measurement in its own right. And so pensions don't fit the bridging notion. The reason they don't fit the bridging notion also explains the difficulty with recycling. We can't find any principled basis for recycling those actuarial gains and losses to P&L. I guess we could recycle them if the scheme was terminated and so everything had finished. But in a sense, that's not really answering the question and the reason why people want recycling. You might never close the scheme. Now, you could do something arbitrary. You could amortize it using a corridor. I mean, they do that in US GAAP still. They use OCI and they amortize using the corridor. But it's difficult to see that there'd be any information value in that amount that was being recycled. It would just be a mathematical exercise. So the third category the board identified were these, it described as transitory remeasurements, which, roughly speaking, were long-term items that are quite likely to reverse or change again, and that would really get in the way if you're just looking at P&L, because they're large swings, they may be a bit not totally connected with the sort of day-to-day business as well. And the board was quite comfortable about using OCI for the bridging items and the mismatch remeasurements. It was much more undecided about the transitory items, the transitory remeasurements. And I think there's a kind of trade-off there. I think the trade-off the board saw was we can either do what people have said and try and come up with a quite tightly defined use of OCI, or we can go more broadly, but at the penalty of not really being able to define it as precisely. And so in the DP, we call that a narrow approach, which just has the first two items, or a broader approach, which has all three items. So the questions we had for you really is, do you prefer the narrow approach or the broad approach? And did you find this notion of the bridging items, the mismatch remeasurements, the transitory items, a useful way of thinking about these issues? Or if you didn't find it useful, is there a better way we should be thinking of it? And one last word on recycling. So with the package we've got here, for the bridging items and mismatch remeasurements, as I explained, you would have to have recycling because it's consistent with the rationale. For the transitory items, the board decided it would be case by case. If it could find a way that would provide useful information, then it would recycle. If it can't find a way, as it hasn't been able to in the pension case, then it wouldn't use recycling.
Ricardo, I'm not saying by my half only, but on the half of a group of professors from Rio de Janeiro. First of all, we understood that before discussing what should be recycled, we should define what should be classified in OCI. So invert the order of the questions that present in the document, and then we agree with the three categories, including the transitory measurement. But in regard to recycling, we don't agree with neither approach, 1, 2A, neither 2B. We understood that we were trying to identify case by case based on those situations presented in the DP. And okay, about the transitory remeasurement, that case by case, not exactly case by case, but present guidances in the conceptual framework on which cases should be those. But in regard to the bridging items and the mismatch remeasurement, we were discussing that might be there are some cases where recycling should not be permitted. I'm not able to explain right now. We are finalizing our draft on that comment, but it was related to the maintenance of physical capital. In some situations we were discussing, they would fit on the categories of bridging items or mismatched remeasurement, and they understood that should not be recycled because of the need to maintain the physical capital. And there is one more point that I would like to address, is that once the conceptual framework is finalized in regard to OCI, we would suggest the IASB to revise IS1 in order to present a structure of to present the OCI. One suggestion would be to classify the statement of OCI in accordance with these three categories. Similarly to what we have in the statement of cash flows, have the OCI from bridging items, OCI from mismatched remeasurement, and OCI from transitory remeasurement. And in each group, present what is recognized and what's being recycled.
Thank you.
Eliseu?
I would at least incentive to work with two different concepts. I agree that it's difficult to work with the recycling when you are dealing with physical capital maintenance. You make the revaluation, okay, how to recycle it back to the profit and loss. Well, we have two different, response. Use the old Dutch model that keeps the revaluation balance in the equity until the line of production of those assets has been discontinued. When it's discontinued, so you don't have to repay those gains, you go with the balance to the profit and loss. Or, as we do here in Brazil and in many countries do, recycle to the accumulated profit and loss. Not profit and loss directly, accumulated profit and loss. So I would say that there are two. I like very much the old Dutch model. Okay, so let's say shareholders, you will not have a big profit because we're depreciating these equipment that has been revaluated, and we need to retain this money because we will have to repurchase these equipment, and we need the money, and so on. When you discontinue that line, for example, Philips has discontinued producing television. Okay, discontinues the line. So everything that has been retained goes now to the profit and the loss, subject to the obligatory dividends as we have in Brazil for profit and loss. That's the problem, they were the same. Okay. So you have the recycling. Just let's make a good choice for when recycling. Or the other way, that to recycle against accumulated profit and loss that many European countries do. And we do here, did here in Brazil when we had the revaluation.
Ricardo, please. Yes. The situation we were discussing was the investment property that first was recognized as property and equipment, then decided to recognize, to classify that, the item to investment property. And then we have the fair value measurement for that item. I wouldn't say that's a transitory measurement. Another case. And in such case, should we recycle that in order to keep the physical maintenance, the maintenance of physical capital? And we are discussing that point right now. Thank you for suggestion.
Ramon, how about the Dutch?
I would say, Amaro, in the end, everything Dutch turns out to be good, no? I'm very happy to hear that, Eliseo. I still would like to discuss this, the transitory category. When I, because essentially when you fixed assets, I disconsider that, because I think perhaps the revaluation guidance in IS 16 and IS 38 was written with a completely different perspective in mind. I'm not sure, but I see it differently from the pension issue. The pension issue is essentially a change in estimates, and relating, affecting past performance. What we normally do, where we have estimates and we change those estimates, the effects of past performance, they run through profit and loss. But with pensions, probably because the sheer size of it, we choose to make an exception for that. That might be fair, but it doesn't change the fact that it is past performance that is being adjusted. To the extent that it's present performance, I think it should run through the P&L. To the extent that it's past performance, I appreciate the political size of an issue as that, and that there might be perhaps different arrangements. But I don't think that it would be part of a principle. I think it would be part of perhaps a very valid exception that is difficult for me to decide, but I don't think it's part of a principle. So my preference naturally goes towards the 2A approach, because the 2B just opens things up to a whole load of other possibilities of remeasurement issues, which I think Yasbi should not go to. But I appreciate that the pension issue is something that perhaps should be looked upon in a different light.
Just to maybe an additional comment on that, I think you pointed to what is the very key question when it comes to OCI, the situations where we have an exception, and this exception is driven by many other factors, but not that are not perceived as strongly enough in terms of conceptual basis. So for the other aspects of CI, I think almost everyone agrees it could be a matter of time to be recycled, such as because of the match principle, or because of the cash flow associated with the issue, could be a hedge accounting, for instance. But for the situations where we cannot really have a strong conceptual basis, this is the difficulty that we have when it comes to defining in a very clear way what is OCI, and then comes to the starting point that made by Ricardo. First, define what should be in OCI. So this is from time to time. And I do understand that, and I think, and I strongly think, as a standard setter, we have to have some room in developing individual standards. So that's why the conceptual framework tries to provide this room and give the board at any point in time enough room to maneuver, I would say, when it comes to the measurement attributes.
Okay. A question that I then have, doesn't the board, in setting standards and going through due process, have that power anyway? Does it have to be in the conceptual framework, or can she just incorporate these exceptions in standards, like we do also for now in leasing, with the contingent liabilities? We make a clear exception because of, well, obviously it falls within the categories of the recognition in chapter 4 in the conceptual framework, but an exception is nonetheless made, and I would prefer to see it. I would prefer the board calling it what it is. We withhold the power to make exceptions for cases that are particularly important to us or to the community at large, instead of building it into a principle. If you would word it but again, that's my opinion. If you would word it exactly the way you worded it right now, and you would say we use OCI for this, yeah, then perhaps there, that explains it for what it is. This discussion paper, at one point, your considerations, because what you've said is also sort of in the considerations, at one point it will disappear, it will get into a standard or into a conceptual framework, and that whole concept might get lost if it doesn't get into the basis of conclusion. And I think it's an extremely important, extremely valid point of the board, and important, but for us also important to know, again, when you are in an IS8 situation and you need to develop an accounting policy, what do I do with transitory? Can I make an analogy to it? Can I not? If you don't want to do that, then you must make it extremely clear, I think. But I appreciate the point. There is no denying it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Should we move on? Go ahead.
And it might be interesting to get a sense from people whether you're more in favour of the narrower use with just the bridging or the mismatch, or of the wider use also including the transitory.
We don't want to have a vote, but can we sense a narrower, broad approach, broader, or the majority? I
particularly would go for narrow approach.
Narrow approach.
And the bridging.
Narrow approach. Can I just, if you don't mind, just put your hands up, the ones that would prefer narrow approach? Yes.
But with a but.
With a but, yeah. Yeah, okay. So the majority would go with a narrow approach, but with some room for, I would say, specific treatments under particular situations and when developing a standard, right? Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so perhaps we should move on to the third topic, which was about liabilities and equity. And the starting point here is that we have an existing definition of equity as a residual interest in the assets less the liabilities. And of course, we have an existing definition of a liability, which really focuses on whether there's an obligation to transfer economic resources or transfer assets, if you like. And we suggested some changes to the definition of a liability, but I think that's not probably particularly significant for the point we're discussing here. And one of the big issues that we saw was that it seems that the natural starting point for trying to distinguish equity instruments from liabilities would be to use the existing definitions of liabilities and equity. But it seems in the standard, particularly IS 32, we haven't wanted to do that. And there are some quite big differences. In the paper, we've reproduced a table which tries to summarize what IS 32 says. And actually, that was quite a difficult summary to produce. It is very summarized, and there's a lot of detail behind that. If you look at the next column as well, IFRS 2 on share-based payments actually sticks much closer to the definition of a liability. So one of the other problems is that there are differences between IS 32 and IFRS 2, and that, for example, that's created some interpretation questions where it's not clear whether something is in the scope of IS 32 or IFRS 2. Now, in a sense, the discussion we've got in the discussion paper is very long and quite detailed and looks almost like a standards-level issue, and the conceptual framework itself may well end up not really saying much about this issue. But I think what we need to understand at the framework level is, have we got a definition of a liability and definition of equity that work? Or does the fact that we have so many exceptions in IS 32 mean that there's something wrong with the definition? So that's really the reason we're looking at it in this project. We had a project on liabilities an equity, or at least it was, it had a different name. The project was called Financial Instruments with Characteristics of Equity, which was being done jointly by the ISB and the FASB, and was suspended in about 2010, I guess, to concentrate on other projects. What we're doing is we've got somebody assigned to work on liabilities and equity, because to understand whether we're going in the right direction in the framework, we need to do quite a lot of the standards level development to understand what the consequences are of different approaches. And the plan is that that research will ultimately come back to an agenda decision about whether we should restart an active project on liabilities equity or not. And if so, also to have a sense of what the direction ought to be for that project at the moment. I should say that if we do that, I expect it would be an ISB-only project. It wouldn't be a joint project. I did notice that two or three weeks ago, the FASB published the results of a consultation they do every year with their advisory council on their agenda priorities. And liabilities versus equity was very high up on the wish list for their advisory council. So it's possible the FASB might do some work, but their starting point is a bit different from ours anyway. What we've done in the discussion paper is we've explored two approaches to making the distinction, two conceptual approaches. One would say we take the existing definition of a liability, or at least with the amendments we're proposing, and if an instrument doesn't create a liability, then it would be classified as an equity instrument. If it does create a liability, we would recognize the liability, or at least there's a liability there, we would need to go through the recognition criteria, but presumably we'd end up recognizing a liability. What that means, of course, is that we may well end up with various classes of equity, not just a single equity instrument. The other approach we've explored is, or at least we considered in the DP, is what we've labelled there as narrow equity, which says there's the financial statements are redirected at the existing shareholders, let's say. There's one class of equity holders that we're looking at it from their perspective, and everything that is not that class of shares should be classified as liabilities. The narrow equity approach, we've been asked by some people, is the narrow equity approach a realistic option, and why are we bringing this? We had a meeting of the World Standard Setters two or three weeks ago, and that was a question a lot of them asked. The reason we brought that alternative is that, first of all, that is one way to simplify the distinction, and secondly, it's actually the way a lot of the equity investors look at it. Not surprisingly, they want to look at it from their perspective, and they think of everybody else who isn't them as sort of coming in front of them and a liability. The disadvantage of narrow equity approach, there's one main disadvantage, there's one slightly smaller one. The main disadvantage is that it's difficult to reconcile with the existing definition of a liability. So if we wanted to do that, we would either have a significant contradiction with the definition, or we would have to investigate an alternative definition of a liability. There's a slightly smaller issue as well, which is we would have to actually define what that narrow class of equity is and sort of who is the most residual, but that's probably a second order issue, but that is one thing we'd need to look at. Now, there is a related issue which is addressed in the second part of the paper, so I should maybe just run through that quickly before coming back to ask you the questions. And that is that if we went with the approach we've explored in the DP, which we've called a strict obligation approach. If there's an obligation, it's a liability. If there isn't an obligation, it's not a liability. So you'd end up with more than one class of equity, or a lot of people would have more than one class of equity. Are you giving enough information for the individual class of equity holders to understand, to get the information they need about their interest in the company? And we felt that the answer is probably no at the moment. And part of the reason is that we have, first of all, we don't have a standard really that covers disclosures about equity instruments. We've got IFRS 7, which covers financial assets, financial liabilities, but we don't have equivalent disclosures for equity instruments. And secondly, there's a concern that a lot of people have that if something's not hitting the P&L, then it's sort of underneath the radar and people aren't going to see it. And the best way to make it visible is to report it as a liability and to have the changes going through P&L. And I think that's a lot of the motivation for some of the exceptions in IAS 32, is to try and get these things visible and to try and avoid financial engineering where there are things that have similar economic effects on the existing shareholders, but there's an obligation in one case there isn't in the other, and being classified differently and having very different outcomes on profit or loss and the balance sheet. And so it seems to us that part of the problem that IAS 32 is trying to do is solve is actually that there are two separate issues. One is trying to say, is the entity required to pay cash or issue some other assets? Or can it avoid paying cash in some circumstances? And the second thing it's trying to do is to show what's the economic effect on other classes of equity holders, particularly existing shareholders, but also others. So you've got a kind of two-dimensional distinction, and we're trying to collapse it into a single distinction, and that's why it's unsatisfactory, because it's trying to do two jobs at once with one distinction. So the approach we're exploring is really trying to approach those two distinctions in different ways. The distinction between obligations to transfer cash and others, it will be captured in the balance sheet distinction, is it a liability or not? The distinction, what's the effect on the other shareholders, we would capture by expanding the statement of change in equity, making the movements more visible and showing the movements for each category of equity holder. In the paper, we've given you an example of how that might look. Obviously, the detail of how it might look is really a standards level issue, not for the conceptual framework. But to give you an idea here, so it's on page 10 of the agenda paper, and it's example 5.1 if you have the DP there. So in this example, we started with two categories of equity holder. We had the existing shareholders, the parents, and we had some non-controlling interest in a subsidiary. And then on the 17th of January, the entity wrote an option, a call option, on its own shares. So if the option's exercised, it will have to issue some shares. And so there's no obligation for the entity to pay cash in this case. So under the strict obligation approach, it will be treated as an equity instrument. And so we've shown a separate column there for that instrument. And what's happening there is an obligation, but it's an obligation to issue shares. It's not an obligation to transfer economic resources. It starts off being shown at 5,000, which was the proceeds and the fair value. And then we've assumed that at the end of the first year, the fair value has gone down to 4,000. And we've assumed that we're measuring this thing at fair value. That's not really a decision that's proposed in the DP, but we've put something in to illustrate it. We chose fair value because if it had been classified as a financial liability under existing standards, it would clearly be at fair value through P&L. So that movement of 1,000, we've described that in the DP as a kind of wealth transfer. What's happened there is that the value of the option holder's interest has gone down from 5,000 to 4,000. So in a sense, they've suffered a loss. It's obviously not sort of a realized loss yet. It's a valuation loss at this point. And correspondingly, the existing shareholders in the parent have got a kind of gain. It's obviously an unrealized type of gain, but there's a kind of gain to them. Similarly, in the next period, the fair value changes again. It's gone down by another 800. And then we get to the exercise date. In the example, it was 15th of December. And at that point, it's in the money. The option holders decide to exercise it. They pay the strike price, which is 1,500. So the equity for the existing shareholders has gone up by a total of 4,700. And of course, the obligation to issue shares is no longer there because it's been satisfied by actually issuing the shares. So that's to give you a kind of flavour of how that might work. I should probably mention one other point as well, which is we've not tried, or two other points perhaps. First of all, as I said, we've not tried to address the measurement of equity instruments. We felt it was a bit premature, really, to get into details of the measurement. We've illustrated it here with fair value for an option, because that seems sort of a natural approach. For other types of instruments, it's more likely to be an allocation of the overall equity, which, for example, is what we do with non-controlling interests at the moment. That's not remeasured, it's an allocation of part of the equity. Secondly, we've not tried to get at all into compound instruments, hybrids, convertible debt, things of that kind. Because clearly that raises a separate kind of question, which is, if you've got a hybrid, do you bifurcate or do you classify the whole instrument one way or the other? We felt that was starting to get into too much detail for a discussion paper, but obviously it's a very significant issue and has a big effect on the outcomes for those instruments. So we've asked you two sets of questions, and in a way it might make sense to ask you to discuss them together. The first is, for the classification, that's in question one, do you think we should stick with the existing definitions of equity and something like the existing definition of a liability, basically an obligation to transfer assets, or should we move to something else? And then secondly, what do you think about the notion of expanding the statement of change in equity and updating the measurements of the different categories of equity so that each category of equity holder can see the effects of the others on them?
Comments? Ramon?
First of all, I think it's safe to say that we would support the strict liability approach that the board is suggesting. And I think as far as question one is concerned, I think we're all, or at least I am, quite comfortable with the definition of liability as it is, and defining what remains as equity. Having said that, I have a question, two questions actually. First of all, with respect to paragraph 5.8, where I appreciate that the board gives examples, and I also appreciate that you said we didn't go into compound instruments yet, but in the examples, if you look at example 5.8a, it mentions shares and other classes of shares and non-controlling interests. Then you have the option contracts. But what for me misses is other instruments that are not shares that might be equity. So my question is there something behind leaving that particular example out? And I know you said you don't treat compound instruments yet, but there are other instruments that are not compound that you still, based on the experience I have right now, might classify as equity, and also reading the discussion paper, but I don't see the example. So obviously you say it's an example, but the fact that it's not there, do I need to read it as a sign? And the other question I have is that I would strongly ask the board to address, because it just gives at least me a lot of headaches in practice, is when you look at liability recognition or the existence of a liability, and you look at the approaches that the board has identified of unconditional, practically unconditional, and conditional, then you get into the question of compulsion. Now, in that section, the board clearly said that constructive obligations are not compulsion, and constructive obligations should be recognized. Does that mean that compulsion leads to non-recognition or classification as an equity instrument? Or is it a separate question? And if it is a separate question, then I would suggest the board to address the question, because it is an issue in practice. And there is diversity in practice, and there is for sure diversity in understanding between Brazil and the rest of the world, or parts of the rest of the world. With respect to the equity, changes in equity, I would say, wow. I appreciate the way it works, even though using retained earnings to me brings about a question again to about the Brazilian situation on distributable profits. But it makes sense, but I think in practice it might be very, very complicated. That is my worry, but I think that one you already expected. There in itself the statement makes perfect sense, but I'm just worried about the complexity.
Perhaps I should make some comments on each of those points. The list in 5.8 isn't intended to be exhaustive, and it's certainly not intended to say that legal form trumps substance. I mean, I think if you're on the strict obligation approach, the test is there an obligation to transfer economic resources or not? All the questions about legal form really are subsidiary to that. We were just trying to give some sort of common categories that to help people understand what sort of things are there. And in the early drafts of this, we actually found people got quite confused if we didn't separate a bit things like existing shares, existing different classes of shares, from derivatives on shares. And so one of the reasons for the discussion around 5.8 was to try and make it a bit clearer when we were talking about one and when we were talking about the other and when we were talking about all of them. And that's why we introduced those notions of the primary equity claims and secondary equity claims without defining them, because we didn't think we needed them as separate categories, but we thought showing them separately might help people understand the discussion a bit better. In terms of constructive obligation versus economic compulsion, we have that distinction at the moment, and the board's line for several years has been constructive obligation is a form of liability, economic compulsion doesn't create a liability. But the distinction between them has not been totally clear. So the discussion in the DP was, can we help a bit with the distinction? At one stage, the board was quite interested in dropping the idea of constructive obligations. This was several years ago. And that obviously means you no longer need to make the distinction at all. What we suggested in the DP is that we should keep that distinction, but try and make it clearer. And in terms of the complexity of the state of change in equity, I think that's obviously right. It would introduce more complexity. I think this is quite a hard sell to the users, because the existing equity investors would probably prefer to read the number that interests them most directly off the foot of the P&L. What this statement says to them is, actually, you can have two instruments that have similar effects. One of them you'll read the effect in P&L, the other you'll read the effect in the statement of change in equity. We can help a bit, I think, by trying to find good places to draw subtotals in the statement of change in equity, and we've tried to do that in the example here, so that you wouldn't get that kind of window dressing, if you like. Yes, the information would be in different places, but it would still be there and it would still be fairly visible. But clearly, it creates some more complexity.
Nelson?
Coming back, Peter, to your two questions, I am personally very happy with the definition of liability the way it is. I think it works. Trying to give the sign that you cannot avoid cash outflow gives the precise idea even to non-experts. And breaking down the categories of equity is also very welcome. We already do that in Brazil for many, many years. And I have a question. We were talking a little bit before the meeting started about these hybrid financial instruments that may be classified eventually as liabilities or thrown to equity. Do you intend to give some sort of guidance here, or that's a matter for a particular standard to address? You know that in Brazil, like in many other places of the world, we're in the middle of a huge discussion with investment bankers, the audit profession, and academics. If there is any sort of guidance that does not belong to the world of bright lines, but could help us to accommodate difficult situations.
I think it's probably not going to be for the framework to say, to get into that level of detail, I suspect. It's possible that the framework might say bifurcating's sometimes a good idea, never a good idea, always a good idea. But I suspect I suspect you couldn't really say any more than that in the framework. I think it would just be too dependent on the specific case. I think it'd have to be left to the standards level. But I think for us to know whether the framework is going in the right direction, we probably need to have some view on where we might go on the standards level project as well.
I should think that that might be an issue to be asked to IFRIC.
I think the problem the IFRIC has with IS32, and it really stopped answering questions on IS32 because there was a project going on. But the problem is they tend to be very fact dependent, and it's actually very difficult for the IFRIC, I think, to pick the issues up, because they're either so specific that they're not worth addressing, or they're so general that you're probably really, you should be doing the standard.
Tadeo? Peter, I like the definition of equity. Sometimes I'm missing this one, especially when we have some complex instruments that definitely doesn't like equity. It stinks like a liability. And because of some sort of, let's say, manipulation of the terms of the instrument, when they try to avoid in any way to meet the definition of liability, and because we know that sometimes it's difficult to make the distinction between equity and liability, and then equity goes as a residual. If it is not liability, it is equity. The point is that some of these instruments, if it becomes equity, the other equity holders will not get anything. And I don't know whether this is a good way to see this type of instrument, but if they are making money as equity, the other equity holders are not making money at all. That's the reason I was missing the economic compelling, the compulsion, because it is a way to determine when actually the real equity holders in a certain way will manage to pay the holders of these instruments.
Any additional comments?
Fabiano?
Answering question one, I think the framework should retain the existing definition of equity as a residual interest category, and that the definition of liability should be used to distinguish between them. However, I have some concerns regarding the definition of liability. DDP defines liability as a present obligation, but it can be conditional at the same time, it be conflicted. How can it be obliged to present and be conditional at the same time? And I think the concept of lack of control could be introduced in the concept of a liability. If the cash outflow is under the control of the entity, it does not constitute a liability. So the issue of constitutive obligations could be solved. Constitutive obligations would not be a liability if it's under the control of the entity, the cash outflow.
Anyone else? Okay.
I think my white hair is very conservative.
So,
you may have the control, but you have the intention to pay. That's the biggest problem we have in this kind of situation. I think I would prefer the definition of the equity, the narrow definition of equity, and not definition of liability. I'm probably too much conservative.
It's not only you, many people think similarly, so as though we are trying to find out the right balance, but you know.
But we should be neutral, no?
Yeah, that's the idea. Isabel?
I agree.
Colonel, please.
I agree with the strict obligation approach, which is totally consistent with the entity theory, and in all the new IFRS, the entity theory is applied. There is an evolution from the proprietary theory to the entity theory, and I think this approach is totally consistent with that.
Thank you. Peter?
Okay, just I think summarizing that discussion, I think I heard most people seem to be preferring the strict obligation approach. One or two exceptions, but seem to be more favoring that than the other. Did anybody have any other approaches other than the strict obligation or the narrow equity that they think we should consider? Okay, that's good. Okay, so does anybody have any other comments on liabilities versus equity before we move on?
Eric?
Even though I respect a lot that men with the white hair for lots of reasons, I disagree with him. I'm going to go with Professor Nelson on this one. I like the strict liability. I think that the idea of I think the idea of the bifurcation, maybe the conceptual framework should address the issue, as because sometimes the problem is not the definition of liability or equity, but what part of the instrument is one, or what part of it is one thing, or when is it one or when is it other. Maybe it should, the conceptual framework should leave some room in order to allow the idea of bifurcation, but not to demand it or prohibit it, but to show that there is the point, that there is the problem, and the problem is mostly on the measurement and the identification, and not on the definition of whatever is liability and whatever is equity. It doesn't seem to me that the problem is on the definition, but on the recognition and measurement of those instruments.
But I guess, Eric, here, that is an issue. Then you get into the issue of unit of account. If you start speaking about bifurcation, then essentially the board needs to get into more detail on the unit of account, and that is one of the big issues you would like input on anyway, I think.
That would be a strange case of not aggregation of things, but a disaggregation of one thing. You would separate, instead of joining assets or joining liabilities, you would separate one of them into different units of account.
Ricardo? Taking Ramon's and Eric's points, I would say, yes, please go further in discussing the unit of account. Of course, the disaggregation. And try to identify a link between the concept of unit of account and whether to use a unit of account and the business model. Probably in many cases, for many instruments, not necessarily the hybrid financial equity or liability, but the unit of account is linked with the way the entity manages
its assets and liabilities. So I saw in section 9 that unit of account is discussed independently from the business model. In my point of view, they should be discussed together.
Okay, so perhaps if there's nothing else on liabilities, we could move into the general session. But this is your chance to raise anything else about the discussion paper that you want to talk about.
This session is free, there's no paper. So it's only an opportunity because we cannot discuss every issue that is in the discussion paper, so we always have some time for you to add anything that you find important. So we start with Fabio Moraes, please.
Okay. It's still related to liability, but it was not a question here, so just to... On the VP, it states that an equity instrument is not an economic resource of the issuer because the issuer cannot have a claim on its own equity. Just for a lot of clarification. So we are talking specifically about the issue and the context of liabilities against equity. It's not in the context of the buyer, because it would be an economic resource for the buyer. So I don't know if it needs more clarification.
Yeah, that's right. We can clarify that if necessary, I think.
Nelson?
Amor, in this general session, I'd like at least to raise an issue that could be addressed in future sessions. It will certainly be addressed in the comment letter that the academic professors in Brazil are preparing to send to the ISB. It does have to do with the definition of an asset. I'd like to confirm whether Peter's understanding is that are we defining the asset as a resource, or we're defining the asset as the benefit coming out from a resource?
No, it's the resource. And we were trying to separate very clearly the resource from the benefit that it might generate, because we wanted to avoid this, I think, confusion that we sometimes get where people focus on whether you can control the benefits you're getting. If the asset is a customer relationship, can you force your customer to pay? Well, no, you can't, but the relationship could still be a resource to you. So we want people to focus on the resource, not the future benefits that the resource might generate.
You'll see our disagreement with that.
Come on.
I had two more questions. First of all, also with respect to an asset, even though not the same question as Nelson asked, I had a doubt about the existence uncertainty. For me, it's very difficult to imagine disconsidering existence uncertainty, because even though I understand the arguments in the DP, I would say, well, if it's applicable to only so few circumstances, then why not include it? But also, how can you have a framework based on assets that might not even exist? That I found a little bit counterintuitive, so I wanted to know what was behind it, understand it a little bit better. And I had, with respect to the control notion and the derecognition, somehow I, even though I appreciate the control notion and that we already have started to use it in IFRS 10 and that it is also proposed in the revenue standard, even though in my view in an entirely different way, with respect to derecognition, I somehow long for a little bit of risk and reward until derecognizing something. Because somehow not having control anymore does not mean I have no more risk and reward. And that this discussion paper doesn't really resolve it entirely, but I, as far as I understand it when I read it, the preference is for the control motion. But I somehow I am left with a little bit of discomfort in that respect.
It is interesting because the point you are making is, was at the core of the discussion we had back in 2009 when we tried to revise the concept of derecognition in IS-39, and we had significant pushback in our tentatives. So, and then we tried to enhance IFRS 7 in terms enhance disclosure, and then emphasize the aspects of risk and rewards and continuing involvement with the asset and things like that. So I would like to hear more on that during, I expect to hear more than on that during the discussion paper feedback, because our recent experience in trying to have a more clear principle for derecognition, asset derecognition, we didn't succeed. Although we had lots of incentives to do that, because we had the recommendations and pressures in the result of the recent financial crisis. That's a very important point. Ricardo, please.
Getting back to section number one, I don't see the ISB as the primary user of the conceptual framework. I think that the ISB should think about the conceptual framework for a more broad audience, not only yourself. In regard to section two, the definition of asset liability, I'm not going back to the point addressed by Nelson, but I don't see why we have the, as a result of past events there, I don't see any help in defining asset liability with that term, as a result of past events, because if I have the control right now, it's a present control. It may came from a past event. And then when you use the result of past events for defining liabilities, that doesn't help in discussing what's the liability, what's the present obligation or not. And one more issue in section two. Let me just take it here. Sorry. Oh, I think I use it to understand what the expected mean in the definition of asset liability. Now I doubt if I understand what's the meaning of being capable of producing economic benefits. I don't know if I'm getting lost in translation, but what does capable mean for the ISB?
Can I pick up a couple of points there? And actually, the last one is one I'd be particularly interested in feedback from you. When we first put capable in the words in the DP, a couple of board members, including MRO, wondered whether capable was going to be clear enough. And we went round in a few circles in the staff, didn't find anything that we thought was better. And it seemed to us capable probably worked for the English speakers, and so if there is a question, it's probably a particular question for the people who aren't native English speakers. But it'll be very interesting your feedback on whether you understand what capable is getting at. Let me explain to you how I think of it. And this is probably partly because I spent a lot of time thinking about insurance type issues. So I think of it as you've got this resource, and then there are various possible future scenarios. There are, I don't know, 100 scenarios or something. And capable means that there's at least one scenario where you're going to generate some benefits. So it's possible you'll get benefits. It's not certain. And there's no minimum limit on how possible it has to be. So long as there's some circumstance when you'll get the benefits, then it qualifies. Obviously, if it's not very likely, the measurement's likely to be quite low, but in most cases. But that was the notion. So it'd be very interesting any feedback from the rest of you on whether capable work fee, or whether we should be looking for other ways to describe.
No, sir.
I wasn't struck by the word capable. I read it very naturally as having the ability of, having the capacity of, being able of. So it sounded very natural to me.
Fabiano?
I would like to make a quote because just mentioned about the purpose of the conceptual framework. I think that it should be done to assist preparers and users in understanding the standards, the application of the standards, not a kind of an internal document of the ISB. Regarding the definition of asset, I think that the control should better define the DP only provide some examples derived from IFRS 10, which I think is that works fine, but I think that control should be better defined because it's a very controversial area. I make echo again for the question regarding past events. I don't think it helps in defining assets because once it's present control, I don't know how it can be useful in defining assets. In terms of liability, I think liability should be a mirror image of an asset. And I would like to emphasize again the conflict between price obligation and conditional, as the board, as the DP proposing view 2 and view 3. I think it's extremely conflicting.
So I just comment on past events. A couple of people brought that up. When we first took it to the board, we didn't include past events. And the board spent a long time discussing it, wanting to understand why we'd taken it out and what the change was. And we said, actually, we don't really think we're making that much of a change, but we think it's not really needed. But it seemed to get in the way of the discussion with the board. They seemed to be spending a lot of time trying to read more into removing it than we'd intended. So we put it back in for two reasons. One was because we thought if it distracted the board, it might distract other people. And secondly, although I think it is redundant, really, in the definitions themselves, one thing we try to do a bit in the DP is to remind people that accounting is about transactions as well. Accounting for transactions is an important part of accounting. And although you might not need it for to decide whether you've got an asset or a liability, once you know you've got an asset or liability, you need to account for it. And so you'll need to account for the transaction that made it an asset or liability. And for that, you probably do need to identify the past event to figure out what kind of transaction it was. So we thought it was probably redundant, but it didn't seem to be causing problems in practice, so why make a change? And it seemed to help with the notion that we're also interested in transactions. So that's why we put it in. Interestingly, we had the same reaction as you from the World Standard Setters meeting 2 or 3 weeks ago, and several of them said, we're not really sure why it's there, maybe you should consider taking it out.
Yeah, just compliment on that. Yeah, Peter is right, and we spend a lot of time discussing something that apparently is obvious. So if you do have a present asset, it's probably because in the past something happened. So... Yeah, of course. So, but it's amazing the amount of time that we spend discussing that. And then at the end of the day, we discuss, well, if it's working, why not keep it just for the sake of not disturbing the discussion around the concept of asset liability. And this might be a very much human being behavior when faced changing. So why we keep discussing, it's becoming more and more obvious that apparently it's not necessary, but of course the feedback will provide us more support in order to go ahead with the concept. Sometimes we spend a lot of time discussing things that apparently are obvious. Ricardo, please.
Probably this is one more example. I would like to go back to the capable issue. Professor Nelson said that he read that naturally as being able to or something. I'm not sure if we should consider being able to or having the ability to and be capable as synonymous in this definition of assets. For instance, as soon as I know Amaro, he has the ability to play basketball, but now he's not capable of playing basketball. Okay, but we are the ending balance. We are in the balance state. Should we account for that item as an asset if he has the ability and is not able to, capable of?
Yeah, but I will recover. On a matter of time, but it's interesting because and Peter rightly described the effort that staff made in understand the outcomes of capable. I had one of his teammates came to talk to me about not only the comment I made during the board discussion, but also if in trying to understand a little bit when translating to Portuguese, because at some point we have to think about the translation in the future of the conceptual framework, what sort of outcome this might have in Portuguese, for instance, or Spanish. So we think about that. And my first, not concern, but the first point I made was that in some sense, some might understand that the word capable might bring together some notion of expectation as well. So, and at the end of the day, we might be changing words, and then the outcome would be, in terms of thinking, somewhat the same. This is the my thinking at the point we discussed it. But you know, this is sometimes your first reaction. And then when you start discussing, it becomes clear. But I think it's an important point. And then particularly because in our effort not to draw so much attention under the probability of something happening. And so this was very much aligned with my initial reaction. Eric, you have additional comments?
All this discussion about what is capable or what is able to do takes me back to the first question by Professor Nelson, that an asset is the resource or is the economic benefit. And I believe that we're discussing that if the resource has to be capable, has to be able, or has to somehow create a benefit, an economic benefit. Therefore, the most important part of this concept is the benefit itself, because if the benefit doesn't exist, the resource has no use. I don't even have to tell anybody on my statement that I have that resource that doesn't give me any benefit. So what is really important on the concept of asset is not the resource itself, but the benefit that arises from it. Therefore, I think that the order of importance should not be a resource that is capable of generating a benefit, but a benefit that arises from the use of certain resource. And in this sense, I think that when the DP here says that, for instance, that from a pharmaceutical research that is in progress, the resource is the know-how. The asset is not the know-how. Because if this know-how doesn't give me any benefit, then I don't have the asset. Then I should not put this resource in my asset. So this is dependent on this idea of what's capable or what's able. Well, if there's not the benefit, the research, then we don't even have to discuss the research. So the most important part is I go in line with Professor Nelson is the benefit.
I just would like to ask you to think about what we are trying also. There are some aspects that we try to do. First is the definition of asset itself. When we talk about the benefits that it generates, somewhat we are talking about, we might be talking about measurement, not really the definition of the asset. And then the recognition. So sometimes you might have an asset or a liability, but you do not recognize for other reasons, not because it doesn't exist. So this is something that we'd like you to think about.
Let me just comment on that and add to that. I think that, okay, you have the problem of the recognition, but the resource itself is, I think, is more related to the recognition process than the benefit, because the existence of the benefit is that makes the existence of the asset. And then you use the nature of whatever is the resource that generates that asset to recognize that on the balance sheet.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand, actually, because are you saying that the asset is the benefit? And are we still having the control notion? So you have to control the benefit. Does that mean you have to control the benefit today? And what happens if the benefit doesn't yet exist today? So if we take some of the examples we've got in DP, if you've got an option, let's say you've got a call option to buy some assets, so the benefit you're going to get is the underlying asset if you exercise the option, but you haven't yet exercised the option, so you don't yet control the asset. Or to take the more basic example, the lottery ticket. The lottery ticket gives you the right to participate in the draw and to get a prize if your ticket is the winning one, but obviously the draw hasn't happened yet. You clearly don't control the prize in any sense. So are you saying that the thing you have to control has to be the benefit, and the benefit already has to exist? And is that not going to risk excluding quite a lot of things that... Or if we turn it over to the liability side, if you have an obligation that's conditional on some future event, so if you're the entity that issued the lottery ticket or the call option, if somebody suggested, and I agree that it's a good idea to have asset and liability definitions that are symmetrical, if the obligation or if the liability is the benefits that you may have to transfer but you don't yet have the benefits, does that mean you don't have a liability today?
Anyway,
let's try to make a bridge, because it's common to teach accounting, just explain the following. The real assets are the economic benefits. These are the economic benefits. But for accounting purpose, we recognize as assets the resources. So it's not to define generally the resources are the assets. No. The assets, in a broader definition, an economic definition, is a benefit, future benefit. But we recognize in accounting the resources that are capable of producing the benefit. So to make clear, if it's, because I agree with the problems of defining the for practical issues the asset as the benefit. So it's a documented thing. Say what is the economic concept of health. And now, for accounting purpose, for this reason, we are going to define as the resources that are able to produce those kind of benefits.
Okay. Nelson?
Yeah, I agree with Peter that there is a difficulty in trying to associate the concept of economic benefits with the concept of control. On the other hand, when I buy stock of Hertz or Avis, or if I buy the companies for myself, I'm not buying a bunch of cars. I'm buying a future cash outflow of a car rental. That's the benefit I'm aiming at. That's what I get.
Okay. Ricardo.
Peter discussed the concept of control. That is another issue that we'd like to address here. In Section 3, the ISB defines control based on the resource. An entity controls an economic resource, and so on.
I suggest the ISB to consider, not necessarily to copy and paste, but at least to consider in discussions, the definition of control made by the IPSA, International Public Sector Accounts on the Board. They define control in IPSA 23, paragraph 7, as control of an asset, not economic resource specifically, but an asset. Control of an asset arises when an entity can use or otherwise benefit from the use of an asset in pursuit of its objectives and can exclude or otherwise regulate the access of others to that benefit. I think this definition of control from the IPSA is really good and is not specific for the public sector, could be applied in private sector as well. I'm not meaning that I don't like the definition that we have there. The definition in paragraph 323 of the DP is bad, but also we already have an accounting standard that defines control. Might be that we should consider whether it's possible to keep with that definition of control instead of developing a new definition of control with different words and control of different things, economic resource or asset in a broader sense.
It's interesting because when we were discussing at some point, I came across to the same definition because I was discussing with someone in Brazil. IPSAs are well ahead in Brazil in terms of implementation, and this was one of the suggestions I made to the staff to consider eventually the some aspects of this definition as well. It's coincidentally. Roberto, please.
I'd like to suggest another subject to be discussed is regulated assets and liabilities. It used to be recognized in old BR GAAP. It is recognized under US GAAP, and it is, in my opinion, it's a good moment for we rediscuss this issue.
Just for clarification, we are actually running a two projects associated with regulatory assets and liabilities. One is a proposal for an interim IFRS. This is going to be discussed next week during the board meeting. This was proposed back in March 2013. And also we are developing a discussion paper on regulatory assets and liabilities. And within the group of experts that is contributing with the ISB, there are a number of experts from all over the world, and Brazil is represented in this group with a professional from one of the largest utilities companies in Brazil. So it's not directly associated with the conceptual framework, but of course the two projects run in parallel, and we are paying attention to both of them. Tadeu?
In relation to concession, especially, we have in the framework when a liability should be recognized on the balance sheet. But sometimes, at least, I don't think that is easy to make a distinction between this concept in the framework and executory contract. We have very few guidance on executory contract, and at least here in Brazil all the time we are having some fights here in relation to whether, especially in relation to concessions, an asset and a liability should be recognized simultaneously. And I know that this is not in the framework, but at the same time, maybe make a distinction between an asset and a liability that are two different transactions, and an asset and liability when they are linked. It means that, especially for concession, just give an example. If I have the increase in my liability, but at the same time I have an increase in my assets. Mm-hmm. I have the right to charge more my user, etc. I can't see from the framework and even from the standards a way to deal with this very important issue for us here.
An additional point, Eric, please.
I know that this issue has already been discussed on the prior the prior discussions of conceptual framework, but I think that it's still being a problem for lots of people, and here by my side is Ricardo that also wants to comment on that, is the idea of prudence and conservatism and faithful representation. I would like to hear from you the idea that when I think about, okay, we have to be neutral and we have to do a faithful representation, but then we have, I put on my balance sheet an asset only when it's right or when I have it, and then when I have 50% plus of liability, I put it on my balance sheet. So this is not conservative. This is not prudent. So when we take out of the conceptual framework this notion, I think that we're taking out of the conceptual framework the very nature of what men have faith on. Because do we have faith on an asset that we know that there is a 50% chance that will happen? Do we have faith on a liability that we know that we have 50% chance? We look at it completely different when we have an information on something that will generate inflows, and when we have an information that will generate outflows. We are conservative as human beings. We are prudent as human beings. So I think I'd like to hear about that, because I'm still a little bit uncomfortable with the idea of taking out prudence. And I'm not talking about the dumb conservatism. I'm talking about prudence.
I saw the first white hair on him. And I saw it physically. It was on Sunday. It was correct.
Yeah, just if I can mention, I've heard that in other situations as well. And of course, this is not in the chapters that we are discussing here, but Peter is going to take into consideration everything we are hearing in developing further. In principle, we don't have the intention to touch or revise the chapters that have already been revised. But of course, we are hearing, and this is our obligation to hear and eventually move from our best former positions. So we have two persons there. I'm not seeing the names, but one is Peter Herzog, and then after him, Aldo, please. Peter, please.
I will come back to the definition of an asset. And rather than introducing a new definition with the capable, my suggestion would be to retain a definition very well known and say at where it has at least a remote possibility of producing economic resources, just for the sake of consistency.
Thank you. Aldo, please.
I would like to speak about the disclosure requirements. I think there has been a huge growth in information and usually most of it useless, and there is a sensation that entities are preparing disclosures following a certain checklist. The auditors want the checklist to be respected because they don't want to have problems with regulators, and in reality what we need is the important information, important disclosure. And I've felt also in the standards a certain tendency to be creating checklists too. In this information here, the snapshot, I see that the reporting entity should inform the group structure, the subsidiaries, associates, parents, etc. That's it exists in the sites of the entities, so it's not important to have it in the balance sheet, because you have the important the information at your disposition, and much more faster in speed than you can register in your balance sheet. So there is a certain tendency from all of us to accommodate in the famous checklist and arrive to an enormous quantity of pages that do not mean almost anything, and we should try to change that position. I would like to know what you think about that, because what is important is what the investor decides about the balance sheet. Do I buy or do I sell those shares? The rest is not important. How do you consider this issue?
I think with regards to disclosure, it's important to mention that in January 2013, the ISB organized a forum to discuss disclosure, because this is a criticism that we are hearing quite consistently around the world, the amount of disclosure and maybe not relevant disclosure. As a result of this discussion forum, we started what we call a disclosure initiative. We at some point discussed within the board if we should include a chapter on disclosure in the conceptual framework, but we decided that at this stage we are not going into developing a disclosure framework, because this would take much more time than we were envisaging to go ahead with this project right now. So, but we do have what we call the disclosure initiative. We are we have a specific team that is dedicated to this disclosure initiative, and working in order to somewhat provide a better disclosure, I would say, framework, although we do have disclosure in multiple IFRSs. So we have to take care with regards to disclosure in specific IFRS that just add information, but the information not relevant. When it comes to disclosure, we identified a number of aspects that it are important to discuss. First is, well, if you do apply IAS 8, IFRS 7, or even IAS 1, and the conceptual framework, you should disclose only what is really relevant and additional to provide a faithful representation. It's already identified that many companies, for reasons, various reasons, they simply override the concept of relevance and then start adding disclosure because of they fear regulatory action, or they do not reach an agreement with the auditors, or they simply cut and paste from the previous years. And this was very much identified, for instance, in accounting policies, where they cut and paste from the IFRS itself, just and sometimes it's not important that accounting policy for that company in that period. So we are very much aware of this, and we are working to enhance our disclosure framework. Peter, would like to add anything on this?
There is a discussion in the DP about disclosure. So I think it's not so much that we won't be putting something in the framework. I think there will be something in the framework to help the board write new disclosure requirements in new standards, so that it knows what it's trying to achieve more clearly, or it's got a more consistent view of what it's trying to achieve. But as Amara says, the work on the disclosure initiative is really in parallel with that. So we expect some things like that. Nelson?
Yeah. So I think that Aldo's point is more addressed to the fact that in a snapshot, it suggests disclosure in the footnotes. And if that word footnotes is excluded, it should be disclosed in the most appropriate way. It's already in the sight of the company. No need to repeat the footnotes. That was the meaning of his observation.
Okay. Ricardo?
Just getting back to Eric's point on the prudence, the way we think that is not the old conservatism concept, but the true prudence concept. Understanding prudence as one of the seven virtues, different from the seven sins. Everyone thinks like those, think on those, prudent, so why not accountants should do that? And one additional point in regard to the stewardship, that I know that ISB also received many comments against removing the term stewardship. I agree with the ISB in that point. I think that the concept of stewardship is still there in the conceptual framework, and there is no need to include the word stewardship there, because it's very difficult to translate, at least to Portuguese. So please, keep that out, but keep the concept as it is. Thank you.
We should come to a close, but Fabiano has...
Regarding the disclosure overload, I think that if we enhance the definition of materiality, I think that we can solve some problems, because today is very difficult to rely on the concept of materiality to remove some disclosures. So we check the boxes to comply, and I think the definition of materiality should encompass the way the entity thinks it's properly to communicate its financial performance.
Okay, thank you. Peter?
Could I just make one comment on prudence? If your comment letters suggest that we should put prudence in, I think it is quite important for you to be explicit what you mean by prudence and what kind of consequences it might have, because there are a range of different things people might mean. I think most people probably do mean the kind of things that Ricardo and Eric were talking about, but it would be good to be fairly clear about that and about the consequences. Because otherwise there's a risk that we'll get lots of letters saying put something back in, and everybody's got different views about what it is they really want put back in.
Any final comment? No? So thank you very much for attending, for participating. I think it was a very interesting session, and we are certainly taking back a lot of thinking about our discussion paper. And of course, I would, as a final point, incentivize you to really put this written down and send us comment letters. This will help us very much. Thank you very much.